This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And every day, we get into the mind, the disturbed mind sometimes.
Hey.
of our rock star producer, Jesse Edwards, and we call the segment Jesse's World.
Morgan Freeman will now guide you on your commute thanks to a new traffic navigation app called Waze.
Well. Look at all that traffic. I told you not to get on this freeway.
The 78-year-old actor has lent his voice to the app and will help get you to your destination by telling you when to make turns, along with some other fun phrases.
Looks like you chose the wrong path.
I'm doing everything you're telling me I'm supposed to do. I don't understand.
Kind of a metaphor for your life, really.
The feature can be unlocked by downloading the Waze app and changing the voice language settings to Morgan Freeman.
Where you want to go now, dummy?
A bizarre, allegedly leaked recording of an alien responding to messages sent by NASA into space is going viral online. A video has emerged which it is claimed includes a genuine recording of an alien reply discovered by NASA in 2012. But the recording, which includes the alien called Shive saying, "I come in peace," has been widely panned as a blatant hoax, even by conspiracy theorists known for their outrageous beliefs. And speaking of outrageous, talentless hack Kanye West was heard throwing a temper tantrum backstage at a recent taping of Saturday Night Live.
"Y'all ain't gonna do this. We breaking the internet. You do it, bro. Bro, by 50%. Stanley Kruger, by 50% more influential than any other human being."
In his rambling, incoherent bloviation, Kanye can be heard comparing himself to Stanley Kubrick and Picasso.
"Don't with me."
Kanye was reportedly upset by the quality of the set that Lorne Michaels had provided when he decided to throw his fit.
"Don't with me."
You might be angry, too, if this is what your music came out sounding like during your crappy performance.
"This is everything."
For Our American Stories, I'm Jesse Edwards.
Oh, you're so good.
Deliver us serenity.
No, make it stop.
Deliver us love. Lord knows we need it.
I think you need it, Kanye. He needs deliverance from himself.
Oh my goodness. So he's 50% more talented than Picasso, is that what he said?
And Stanley Kubrick, I guess.
And Stanley Kubrick. He didn't say 50%, 50 cent, or he said 50%. I didn't get that.
I don't know.
I think he said 50%.
Bell! Bell! Bell!
How was the audience there at SNL?
Boo! Boo! Rubbish! Filth! Slime! Muck! Boo! Boo!
That's the general consensus.
Oh, I think so, too.
Oof.
Not a big Kanye fan myself, so don't understand it. Don't get it.
It's so bad, I think, at this point. He's maybe it's just an act because he can't get any publicity unless he's just completely terrible.
I'm just a naughty by nature guy. I'm old school rap when it was more musical and a little less angry.
And you could dance to it.
And you could dance to it and you could have fun with it. And even some of the social messaging rap, and I wasn't into it, but I mean, you could at least say, my goodness, there's some talent. I just don't get Kanye.
KRS-One,
yep.
Boogie Down Productions.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, Kanye's a little bit in debt, $53 million.
That's it?
Yeah, and he tweeted Mark Zuckerberg, "I know it's your birthday, but can you please call me tomorrow to give me a loan."
Give me some money?
And he went on, "I'm this generation's Disney. I want to bring dope let's just say stuff to the world.
Dope stuff.
I don't have enough resources to create what I really can. Yes, I'm personally rich. I can buy furs and houses for my family.
Ugh.
But if I spent my money on my ideas, I cannot afford to take care of them. I'm in a place that so many artists end up."
Oh,
don't you just feel bad for him?
Woe is me.
I would rather listen to my dog lick itself for an hour than to listen to Kanye for another
Thanks
minute.
Thanks for that image, Jesse.
You just had to do it. Huh?
You know, speaking of music, I think it's time for a segue. That is some music, and that's Jimmy Page's guitar work, opening the song 10 Years Gone, on Led Zeppelin's sixth studio album, which came out tomorrow on this day in history, called Physical Graffiti. In 2006, this record went platinum 16 times, and it was a double record. And this is back in a day when a record would have a solid 1 minute opening like this. No words yet. I'm still talking. And only Zeppelin could have done this record. They recorded it in a home. Imagine that. In a home. And take a listen.
Then as it was, then again it will be. Though the course may change sometimes, rivers always reach the sea.
A sound like you've never heard before. Young people still downloading this record. Let's take a listen to another song on this record. Custard Pie. And then, of course, there was the masterpiece on this record. Eight minutes long, I think, something like it. Kashmir. And we will close out with this song. It took a long time for this album to become record, said Robert Plant, because we originally went into our studio to record it. But one of our musicians, John Paul Jones, wasn't well. We canceled everything. 3 months later, we got the situation sorted out. And it came out pretty fast. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories on this day in history. Tomorrow, Physical Graffiti recorded by Led Zeppelin. More after these messages.
Top of days for which they sit away.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and every other week, we'll bring you a feature called Women Who Dare. That's from the New York Times bestselling author Gail Sheehy. It profiles women who dare, what they dare to do, and why they dare to do it. This week, we're bringing back to you Gail's very first feature on a journalist who dares to give a voice to the Syrian rebels in their daring fight for their future against two mortal enemies, ISIS and Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad. We're bringing back the feature because this journalist was just detained in Bahrain as a, quote, suspected terrorist. We play Gail's feature and then hear from her live about this harrowing update.
Today's daring woman is a beautiful blonde 20-something American woman from Boise, Idaho. When she first started reporting from the Middle East in 2011, Anna Day stuck out like a daisy in the desert. But she stuck it out from day one of the Arab Spring in Egypt to the chaos in Syria today, 5 years later.
I realized, you know, instead of being frustrated that I'm often undermined because of my age and my youth, that I needed to really turn that into an asset. Mm-hmm. And the Arab Spring was the perfect climate to do that because, you know, I was interviewing my peers. The Middle East, 70% of the Middle East is under 30.
Wow, perfect.
So I got to, you know, interview and interact with them in a very different way because I was their peer.
Anna, what made you drop everything and fly into Cairo?
I had a lot of Egyptian activist friends who I had met while studying Arabic in college. When Tunisia fell to a revolution, they called me and they said, "Get down here, Egypt is next." I didn't think in a million years it would happen. I saw the conditions under which they had been organizing for years. It was very dangerous to be an activist there. But I said if I were to miss a revolution in Egypt, I would never forgive myself.
What was it like in the middle of Tahrir Square?
The first day of these protests that were called, I woke up and the blogs and a lot of the internet had been shut off by the government. Then I started walking towards Tahrir Square, and it was flanked with rows of police officers at every road that leads into the square.
A very clear sign.
As I reached the square, I heard a kind of chorus of protesters coming. And as I approached the square, they approached it from the other side, and I entered the square the minute they broke into the square and broke that police front line for the first time.
So you were right on the spot. And how did you let news organizations know that you were there?
I got a million pictures from that moment. I knew I was in the middle of something really special. I saw women, young people, people who were Muslim and Christian of all backgrounds protesting. So I got those pictures, and that night I put them online saying, "The revolution has begun."
From Cairo, you began making a circuit of Middle East revolutions. You went from reporting in Egypt to Bahrain to the Libyan war. And then why Syria in 2011?
I met activists from Syria who had come to Egypt to learn about revolutions, and they started telling me about the kind of horror that was going on in their country and the lack of journalists. So these young people encouraged me and other journalists to come early on. So when these war reporters died inside Syria, many of the Western news organizations decided to pull out.
And that was the beginning of an almost complete shutdown of Western journalism in Syria. What was your impression of the war in your first year of covering Syria? Was it Syria? Was it just another civil war, like Iraq seemed to be in the beginning?
For me, I had never seen anything like it. One of my first experiences in Aleppo was in a hospital. I was inside doing an interview with doctors. One of those first barrel bomb attacks happened in Aleppo, and a stream of people started coming in. Women, children of all backgrounds coming in maimed, and I froze. I really didn't know how to handle that situation.
Never been in it before.
It's a total shock
the first time.
Yeah, and I really froze. I didn't know to just continue photographing the streams of people coming in that were maimed. And while in that moment where I froze, the hospital started getting shelled. By the fall of 2012, I felt I had seen enough war crimes that this war couldn't possibly continue into 2013.
The UN would stop it. America would stop it. Mm-hmm. The world, sane world, would stop it.
And now it's 2015. Yeah, a young man said to me, I said, "Okay, listen, like you have a gun now. Now you're a combatant. You're not the nonviolent protester." And he said, "First of all, this is armed resistance. We're defending ourselves. They're bombing our schools and our hospitals and our homes." And he said, "And secondly, this is our American Revolution. You guys defended yourselves from tyranny with guns, and we're fighting for our right to vote."
The fact that you were a woman, how did that work with Arab men?
A lot of them are very shy because they have a more conservative society.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them have been very protective. I've had Syrian rebels make sure I had my separate sleeping quarters, and they locked me in a closet in this little compound that they were defending, and they said, "We feel so bad, but this is your free Syrian hotel. Welcome." And they did bring me strawberries the next day, saying, "We wish we could bring you more than this."
You got an amazing scoop in 2013. The Daily Beast published it with this headline: "Dining with Al-Qaeda." They didn't even realize they had an even bigger scoop.
I sat down with a group of foreign fighters who were part of a group called ISIS.
Your publisher didn't recognize ISIS and changed the headline, called it Al-Qaeda, right?
Yes. And, you know, a year later, obviously, that would have been the leading headline. And at the time, it just sounded like I was, you know, too into the weeds of this story, making distinctions between these rebel groups. Mm-hmm. But inside Syria, that distinction had become incredibly important. And ISIS at that moment, not Al-Qaeda, had the momentum.
What did these guys tell you was their motivation?
So they were fighting a war of defense in many ways. They came to defend the women and children that I also saw being bombed, but they were doing it for a different end game than the Syrian people. The Syrian people were fighting for the right to the vote, while these foreign fighters are fighting for the reestablishment of the caliphate.
And they were eventually, it didn't take them very long to be fighting on both sides of the border of Syria and Iraq.
Yes.
And establishing the beginning of their caliphate.
Yes, that summer there were major developments on both sides of the border of Iraq and Syria, both because of the Islamic State. At the time in the West, we were still reporting on these two countries as separate theaters, and they were talking about developments in Iraq separately from developments in Syria. But the big point at that moment was these developments were coming with a very deliberate organization from one specific group.
What is your hope now that Russia is bombing to buck up the Assad terrorist regime? We don't know who's fighting whom. All we do know for sure is that the Obama administration has finally killed the Pentagon plan to train and arm Syrian rebels. A couple of months ago, they found out their $50 million effort had provided only 5 rebels who didn't run away when there was an attack against them. So they've disbanded it. So we've walked away from the fight.
There's not a lot of points of opportunity in Syria, but there still are a few. And if the U.S. politically cannot get involved in a military capacity at this point, there's certainly a way to be involved in terms of absorbing refugees and in terms of supporting our allies in the region who do support refugees, our allies in Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon. So I think the U.S. has failed to lead in the civilian realm. But on a military realm, the people of Syria only asked for weapons after a no-fly zone was denied to them. So from their perspective, it was very logical. If you won't defend us from the jets that are bombing our elementary schools, then let us defend ourselves. Give us some guns. Give us some anti-aircraft missiles and artillery to do something, to defend ourselves.
What kind of daring does this chaos reporting take?
Well, it would be a day-by-day risk assessment to make sure that, you know, we're keeping our team safe and the Syrians that work with us on the inside, but also, you know, honoring this story. We've seen so many of our colleagues die for this story. We've seen so many civilians live through this horror. And again, we see Assad emboldened by the lack of coverage and the lack of accountability. So a lot of journalists are committed to keeping this story in the headlines and, you know, conveying it in, with the urgency that it will take to hopefully ignite some kind of policy change.
A very brave young American from Boise, Idaho, who's been risking her life for 5 years to keep reporting on this terribly sad part of the world. Thank you, Anna Therese Day.
Thanks, Gil.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and that was New York Times bestselling author Gail Sheehy's feature, Women Who Dare. After the break, Gail will join us live to bring us up to date on this story and Therese Day's story of her detainment in Bahrain as a suspected terrorist. More after these messages. More with Gail Sheehy. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and every other week we'll bring you a feature called Women Who Dare. And that's from the New York Times bestselling author Gail Sheehy. It profiles women who do daring things and what they dare to do, and more importantly, why they dare to do it. And this week we brought Gail back, and we brought back, as you just heard, our very first feature on a journalist named Anna Therese Day, who had dared to give voice to average citizens in the so-called Arab Spring revolutions across the Middle East. We did so because she was just detained in Bahrain as a suspected terrorist. Gail, why did this happen? What was the context? Give us a setting to the update on this story we did a while back.
Well, here you have a fearless freelance journalist, only 27 years old, Anna Therese Day, whose luck held out for 5 years as a freelancer, documenting the Arab Spring in Egypt and Syria, Libya, Bahrain, and then in the last years, couple of years, the rise of ISIS in Syria, where very, very few reporters dared to go or were sent by their news organizations. But Anna Day was fearless. But in the last week, she went to Bahrain with several, with a film crew to cover the fifth anniversary of a revolution that was relenting, unrelenting in that small Gulf kingdom. And she knew that there would be repression of the protesters, and sure enough, there was. And the curious thing was that from the main highway, this place looked like Singapore, glistening skyscrapers. It looked very luxurious. But beyond the highway, she could see smoke from tear gas and Molotov cocktails, and there was obviously something different going on in the neighborhoods. So she connected with the activists she had met when covering their revolution 5 years ago, and they took her to these neighborhoods where, on a daily basis, there were clashes between police and protesters for the last 5 years. And mothers and fathers and a lot of children were continually disappeared. They went into jail. Tortured bodies were released or thrown out in the streets as a warning to other people. They had one of the worst human rights abuses records compared to North Korea. And so she was where she wanted to be to film what was going on in this very, very violently repressed Middle Eastern country.
And Gail, the consequences of her daring have been pretty stark. And we know how Western journalists are treated in these parts of the world. Heck, we know what happened to Daniel Pearl. Oh, my goodness. That was a pretty tough sentence. That was death. Talk about...
Well, we know what happened to Jim Foley,
you bet,
who was a colleague of Anna Day's and was beheaded on television. So that was the only time when she completely froze and couldn't write that about that atrocity. But she was back again, you know, 5 years after the original Arab Spring, having reported from Syria up till last year, and there in Bahrain. And the reason she was there, Lee, is that unbeknownst to most of us, Bahrain is one of the most strategically important military bases for the U.S. in the whole world. It's the home of our Fifth Fleet, and they are guarantors of the world's oil supply. And as a result, we haven't really heard any protests by the U.S. government about the human rights abuses in Bahrain. And Anna Day wanted to document those and bring that story out. But she was arrested and with her crew, and they were treated in a very terrifying way.
And it's interesting. The authorities there used Google to figure out who she was so they could then arrest her. And talk about that,
right,
Gail. It's fascinating.
Well, you know, we don't necessarily think that, you know, security forces in a little-known island in the Red Sea called Bahrain would actually Google to find out who an American was. But they did, and they found out she'd written a story about a tweet written by one of the protesters in Bahrain. And because she repeated it in a social media in America, she was already suspect. And they were throwing around charges like terrorist, agitator, charging these four Americans with doing all kinds of, you know, with participating with the protesters rather than being journalists who were covering the protests, which is exactly what they were doing.
And what's been the sentence? What's been the punishment meted on this daring young journalist? What's happened to her, Gail?
Well, what happened to them was initially very frightening. They were separated, all four of them. She was taken to four different police stations around over through the night, asked to call the embassy, wasn't able to call the embassy, not able to call her lawyer or a family. So nobody knew. They were just, you know, they had disappeared. And finally, she couldn't stand it anymore. They handcuffed her feet and her legs, put her legs in irons. No food, no sleep, no water. finally, she had to act like a crazy person to say, screaming and crying, I have to call the U.S. Embassy. You must let me call the U.S. Embassy. And they finally did. But even then, they were whisked off with her crew to a court where they were charged and given a sentence hanging over their heads of from 10 days to 2 years for being agitators. And again, she had to throw a fit and say, I am not going to prison for 2 years. You know we're journalists. You know we're only covering this story. You have to let me speak to the embassy. And finally, the embassy did come to show up for them. And the charges still hang over their head, but they were finally allowed to leave. However, all of their gear was taken, all of their cameras, all their laptops. The only thing that wasn't taken, which was Anna Day's, being a daring journalist, her primary concern was the film they had shot. And when she was reunited with her crew, they said, where's the film? And she whispered to them, I have it. Don't ask where.
Good for her. Good for her. And Gail, you know, what's interesting to me is, and I'm, you know, I may even press you on this. I think this is one of these recurring stories that more Americans should know about. The repression of women in the Middle East, the repression of gays in the Middle East, the repression of human rights in the Middle East. Look, as we said before, just before we went on the air, there is a race to the bottom in this part of the world and in some parts of Africa right now for human rights that match or maybe exceed what's happening in North Korea, Gail.
Well, you can't really believe how widespread it is. And you know, there have been lots of journalists killed in Bahrain. I mean, Bahraini journalists.
Yep.
Mothers and fathers, and especially children, young teenagers, are routinely disappeared in the middle of the night and kept in solitary confinement and often, you know, sexually abused, tortured until they confess, usually on camera, and then bodies dumped in the streets to intimidate future protesters. So, you know, what you have in the Middle East is the dominant population is under 30. So there's all kinds of hope for young people who are connected to the world, who do use Google on a routine basis, who know there's other ways to live than under this kind of repression. And in Bahrain have kept up a kind of minor revolutionary fervor for 5 years. But when you have that kind of repression and no other government like the U.S. government that's there challenging them on it, as we have done with so many other countries, they just get away with it.
Well,
so I'm glad to be able to report this story, and I hope that people will look at the website Jezebel, where the whole story is being written and will be there tomorrow.
Well, Gail, thank you for this reporting. Thanks for the continued work. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, Women Who Dare, an update on the life of journalist and rock star Anna Therese Day. This is Lee Habib. More after these messages. And this is Our American Stories. No, that's not the sound of our editing bay before we get to work. Though I wish it was. It's just a dad goofing off with his kids, making them laugh, tickling them, teasing them, making facial gestures. No better sound in the world than a human being laughing, young or old. Somehow as we get older, we don't laugh as much. Shame on us. I think that's why we have kids. And then they grow up and we want to pull our hair out. And we love doing stories out of the personal journal, the part of the Wall Street Journal that we know America loves, and the more Americans can get in touch with the personal part of the Wall Street Journal, called the personal journal, the better. It's in there in the fourth section of the paper. I start my day every day going there first to get my sensibilities tickled. And one story in particular caught our attention a while back, and it was, why are some people more ticklish than others? That was really the title. And I'm a curious guy, and it has a picture of a mom, by the way, tickling her child, and it's a beautiful picture. And I want to lead with the read of the piece. It starts off like this. Wiggly fingers approaching the armpits can elicit giggles from some people. For others, even a feather caressing the toes will bring about no response. Scientists are perplexed by the variability and the origin of the tickle response. And that's why we brought Heidi Mitchell on to join us. Heidi, thanks for coming.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So how, but before I even start, where do you get this story? I mean, how does this story stumble upon you?
Well, we have this column every other Tuesday in the personal journal section, and they are quirky. I'll give you that. This one came from the editor of the section, who happens to have, I think, a 3-year-old. And so it was actually her idea. She was wondering, how come he's so ticklish and I'm not ticklish at all? So we're all like hovering around 40, and did a little census, and none of us are ticklish anymore. So we wanted to know why the heck not.
Wait a second. You work with a bunch of people who aren't ticklish anymore? What's wrong with you all?
Well, you know, we took very scientifically a feather around and tickled people, and they didn't giggle. They giggled. You know, we giggle because we think it's fun and funny.
Right.
But that response of the actual tickle feeling, it just isn't there anymore.
And so tell me this.
Pretty much nobody.
And nobody. Tell me, and by the way, this is the burning question column, by the way, in the personal journal, and this obviously was the burning question you had to solve.
We are fun, interesting people at the Wall Street Journal that happen to not be ticklish, along with the rest of the world.
Wow. So let's work this down now. So you went and you talked to neuroscientists, and one, David J. Linden, and he was at John Hopkins. I mean, pretty fancy name, pretty fancy hospital. What did he teach you?
Well, I love this guy because he spends all day studying mice in the lab, and he happens to be, so he's a neuroscientist, and he works on various responses in the brain, but he doesn't specifically work on touch. He's just a fanboy is what he calls himself. So he is a fanatic about our sense of touch and thinks that it involves many, many different senses. So he went around and spoke to all of these experts in the field and wrote this book, The Science called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And he's fascinated with the subject, and he's fascinating to talk to, and he has so many thoughts, and he's a fantastic interview, which is kind of a rare find.
Yep.
So he was our guy, and he gave, you know, we like to call it an informed opinion, because a lot of times science isn't totally behind a lot of the subjects that we cover, like tickling, not a ton of research on it.
Well, tell me this then. I'm going to read, because I love reading from writers' work, and then you just advance the ball. At this point, early in the article, you write, some scientists have argued that being ticklish is a defensive reflex against attack, but Dr. Linden finds that explanation wanting. Why is that?
So if you think about it, it kind of seems like that's a good explanation, right? Like the places where you're super ticklish, you know, around your neck, where you have a major gland, where you have major vein around under your armpit. So that works. But then when you think about like your bottoms of your feet, well, that's not going to kill you in battle, right?
Right.
If you're stabbed in the foot or something like that. So that's why Dr. Linden believes that this isn't really a fully thought through idea. So he doesn't think that that's why we've evolved. All these things are evolutionarily based. I mean, I'm a firm believer in trying to understand why we do what we do based on evolutionary devices. So he doesn't believe, and I agree with him, he doesn't believe that it's a reflex against attack. Doesn't seem to carry through.
So then he goes on, and I'll read again. He compares being ticklish to having an itch, which most experts believe evolved as a protective measure against infestation by insects or worms. Talk about that.
Kind of gross, but yep. Kind of makes sense. Because when you're itching, when you have an itch, like a tickle, it's a specific kind of feeling that requires an immediate response.
So unlike pain, which can be chronic or you can it can linger and you cannot deal with it, like a headache or a throbbing or something even that's acute but passing, an itch like a tickle, it provokes a very immediate response. So you might think that the tickle response is like, oh, there's like a worm crawling on me. I'm living in the cave. I'm thinking of cavemen.
Right.
And I'm living in a cave and there's like a bug or something. And so it's ticklish. And so I go, ah, and I immediately push it away.
Right.
But honestly, and that seems to be a pretty good explanation because bugs tend to be tickly on us. But, you know, it hasn't been scientifically proven.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You wrote here, still, the neuroscientist says, we honestly don't know why humans are ticklish. By the way, I love it when a scientist can have some theories, but then just finally admit, look, we study this 8 different ways. I'll tell you something else that was interesting, though. He says there is no indication being ticklish is inherited. He has seen tickling across every culture. So imagine this. He's studying tickling across cultures and says the behavior is often informed by social norms, taboos, and the setting in which it takes place, which, by the way, would be my theory. He says then, if someone is really angry, you can't tickle them. Talk about that, the setting.
So I think that the non-inheriting part of it is so fascinating, right? Because you often hear people say, oh, I'm ticklish because my dad is so ticklish, you know, and it's just never, there's no link proven. There's no, he said, I wish I could just, you know, take the ticklish part of your feet and dissect it. And I'd find like a whole bunch of neurons affiliated with the tickle response, but it's just not there. They have just doesn't exist. And even though, and actually he's seen ticklish across, being ticklish across every single culture, yes, and also in lemurs. He said he's seen videos of lemurs that seem to have a human-like response to being tickled. And you've seen it with, like, your dog, your cat. I mean, they seem to, like, enjoy it. I don't know if it's the same quite response, similar response, but not quite the same. But what is so important is the situation. So tickling, unlike many other of our responses, is so situational. So if you're in love with somebody and you're having a moment and you're looking into each other's eyes and he like caresses your face, you know, you might tickle and giggle and it feels good. If you're in the middle of a heated argument and he does the exact same thing, you're not going to feel that same.
Oh yeah, I've tried that. I've tried that one. That doesn't work. My wife doesn't let me do that. That doesn't get me anywhere. Let me share this from you.
It's not going to break the argument, that's for sure.
Not breaking the argument, maybe breaking a bone in my body, actually. I got to be careful when I get too clever.
Elbow.
Exactly. So most people, you wrote here also, aren't able to tickle themselves. And here's where the doctor says something interesting. When you go to tickle yourself, your brain is sending a message to the tickling hand, and a copy is going to the cerebellum, which sends inhibitory signals to dampen the sensation. We know this because people who have damage to their cerebellum are able to tickle themselves, says Dr. Linden. Now, this is really fascinating. I've never actually tried to tickle myself. I went ahead and actually did try, and I couldn't. And I am still very ticklish. We'll get to that in a second. Talk about why, as people get older, they tend to lose the ticklish sensation they once had.
Well, first of all, the not being able to tickle yourself thing is so interesting because basically what's happening is, and this is again evolutionary, so you're walking down the street and your clothes are kind of rubbing against you and they're kind of tickly if you were to think about it,
mm-hmm.
but you don't think about it because you have to think about, well, am I being attacked? What food do I want to eat? Who do I want to mate with? So our bodies, our minds have evolved to take that signal of your clothes rubbing against your body, just as an example, or your hand moving toward your wrist to caress it, and copies that message and sends it to your cerebellum. It says, just don't think too much about that. It's not important. Focus
right.
on, you know, mating and finding food and shelter.
Right.
So that's why you can't really tickle yourself. As far as getting older, you know, it's not totally proven, but the thought is that starting at age 20, you start to lose a little bit of your nerve endings on your skin as you get older.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very small, like 1% a year.
Right.
So that old people maybe don't have any feeling of any sensation on the bottoms of their feet, which is one reason why maybe they fall more often. It's just one of many, many reasons. But there's other responses that the nerve endings are no longer quite attuned to, like heat and cold and pressure and pain. And so as we get older, yes, we become less ticklish. It's just one of the many senses that diminish as we get older. So I guess if you live to 100, like we're all going to live to 100, we won't be hot, we won't be cold,
awesome.
And we won't be ticklish.
There's some good things come of this.
Won't feel pain, maybe.
Heidi, we love this. Email us when you have stories like this. Heidi Mitchell, tickling the Wall Street Journal. Go figure. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Back with more after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and you're listening to the soundtrack from Schindler's List. And on this day in history in 1997, an estimated 65 million people tuned in to watch all or part of Steven Spielberg's Oscar-winning Holocaust drama on NBC. NBC broadcast the film in its 3.5-hour entirety, uncut and uninterrupted by commercials, as per Spielberg's request. The network made some effort to warn viewers about the film's mature content, airing a message from Spielberg himself cautioning that the content was not appropriate for young viewers. Still, the number of viewers who watched that night at home was more than double the number who watched it in the theater when it was released in 1993. And so we decided here to bring back our tribute to Oscar Schindler on the day he died. And let's go back to that this day in history.
Why did he do it? Why did he spend 4 million German marks keeping Jews out of the death camps? An enormous sum of money for those times. Why did he risk his life to rescue Jews in the shadow of Auschwitz? After all, Oskar Schindler does not exactly fit the description of guardian angel. We think we know what goodness looks like. It looks like Gandhi, skinny and dressed in his handmade loincloth. Or Mother Teresa, drab and subdued in her nun's habit. Goodness does not drink, womanize, and wear Nazi patches. Or does it? In his acclaimed international bestseller, Schindler's Ark, the author Thomas Keneally tells us that one of the most common sentiments of the Schindler Jews is still, "I don't know why he did it." Keneally drops a hint in his description of Oskar Schindler's childhood. A strong Catholic household and deeply religious parents. The nearest neighbors were a Jewish rabbi family, and the two sons were Oskar's closest friends for years. To Helen Rosenzweig, a Jewish maid at the Krakow concentration camp, who presently lives in Florida, Schindler's close relationship with the Nazi SS camp commandant and his concern for Jews was confusing.
He took me to the window. He says, "You see the people down the hill? They carried stone. They were digging the hill." He said, "Look at them. Watch them. You see people in Egypt, you Jewish people, when they were enslaved, and then they were freed from Egypt? This is what's going to happen to you. You will see. You're going to be free from that hell."
Schindler made good on his promise. He also saved her siblings. In a 1964 interview, standing in front of his dingy apartment in West Germany, Oskar Schindler for once commented on what he did. "I felt the Jews were being destroyed. And it didn't mean anything to me that they were Jewish. To me, they were just human beings. I had to help them. There was no choice." Schindler was so obedient to practice love towards imprisoned Jews that he eventually paid a price. Here's one of Schindler's Jews who immigrated to the United States after the war. Leon Lason.
On one occasion, he had his birthday party, and some of the inmates baked a cake, and a young girl, took it up to the office and gave it to him. So he gave her a kiss. And this, of course, was a major crime during that period of time.
Schindler was subsequently arrested. It was one of three separate arrests, but he was able to talk and bribe his way out of all of them. On the eve of May 8, 1945, Oskar Schindler had important news that the Jews in his care waited 5 years to hear. Here again is Holocaust survivor Leon Lason.
Schindler asked us all to gather around. He stood up on something high, and he told us that we were free. The war is over. The Germans have surrendered, and that he was going to leave, and these guards who were standing around behind him were going to leave as well, and he wished as well.
Also present at Schindler's announcement was Sol Urbach, who settled in New Jersey in 1951. Here he describes the reactions from his fellow Jews.
Everyone there was either in tears or in laughs, or trying to crawl toward Schindler to kiss him and thank him personally, which was impossible to do with 1,000 people. It was an emotionally charged gathering where we just were short of being able to express our feelings, the unbelievable achievement that we have survived the war, and it was Oskar Schindler that brought us to this point.
Following World War II, Oskar Schindler was isolated and rejected by his fellow citizens. He was called a Jew kisser, sworn at on the streets, and stones were thrown at him. Nobody would do business with him. There was even an attempt on his life. It was said that he was their bad conscience, the conscience of all those who had known something but did nothing. 2 decades after his release, Leon Lason reunited with his rescuer in Los Angeles. He wasn't sure Schindler would recognize him, but no reminder proved necessary.
I reached out my hand and started to introduce myself because I realized, you know, I was a grown man, and last time he saw me, I was not yet 15, you know. So he interrupted me. He says, "I know who you are. You're Little Lason."
Oskar Schindler took on perhaps one of the toughest forces of the 20th century, the Nazis, saving over 1,200 Jews during a time where over 6 million were being exterminated. If you picked up a handful of sand, it would have over 1,000 grains. Over 1,000 souls lived because of one Oskar Schindler. On October 9th, 1974, Oskar Schindler died. Upon his request, they buried him in Israel. 500 of his survivors were there. This Day in History.
And our This Day in History segment is brought to you by our sponsor, Hillsdale College. The best place to go to study. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, it can get to you. Go to hillsdale.edu for all of their great courses. The life of Oskar Schindler celebrated on this day when NBC made the decision to play Oskar Schindler's story, Schindler's List. And 65 million Americans tuned in to an uncut, unfiltered view of the man's inhumanity to man on full display. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories. Whenever we talk to folks about what's going on in their minds, especially parents, we inevitably circle around to what's going on with this younger generation, the millennials. By the way, every generation judges the generation after it. And Steve Toback recently wrote a piece on Fox Business called The Millennial Mindset and America's Productivity Crisis. And it's now out with a book called Real Leaders Don't Follow. And that expands on this topic. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
You know, in your article, you ask us to stop doing three things when it comes to thinking about the younger generation. What are they? Just go run them down bullet by bullet for my audience.
Well, the first one is quit trying to deal with a certain generation as if they're either special little snowflakes or entitled narcissistic brats, and start holding them accountable as unique individuals.
All right.
The second one is, that said, those unique individuals need to quit doing such an effective job of living up to those Generation Me stereotypes. Put on their big boy pants and get to work. And the third one is, this is my favorite, and their coddling parents should quit acting as if they had absolutely nothing to do with the demon spawn they raised, and stop blaming gadgets, schools, and society in general.
Well, you know what? We love them. We love them, Steve. And we're hearing this. It's interesting. We're hearing this from parents. But the parents are always talking about someone else's kids. Mm. And everybody's talking about everybody else's kids. And in the end, we're all doing this, and we're all blaming something else. So let's talk about the coddling parents first, and dig in with that, and that, and this generation of parents that have produced this generation of kids.
Well, I think that's sort of the greatest irony of what you just said, that everyone's sort of talking about other people's kids. It's even worse than that. Everybody's talking about the kids being the problem, and the real problem, obviously, is the parents.
Of course.
You know, kids did not make themselves this way. Certainly not an entire generation. And by the way, you know, as I said up top, it's, you know, the whole profiling a generation thing is a bit funky, and I caution against it. But nevertheless, they are doing a pretty good job of making us see them a certain way. But at the end of the day, we clearly made them, and we made them what they are, and they... and. You know, one of the principles of my new book, Real Leaders Don't Follow, is that real leaders do things by, you know, they teach by example. And where did the kids learn this kind of behavior from? They're living in an entitled society. And the entitlement goes all the way up and down the food chain. It includes the government bureaucracy. It includes... oh, you know, CEOs who make big bucks, a lot of them get great exit deals when they fail.
Yep.
You know, it's just the kids are learning it from everybody.
Well, and you know what else they're
so,
learning?
You know, blaming the kids, you know, it's a double-edged sword.
It is. And, you know, it's interesting. I counsel through my church periodically couples on finance. And they don't seem to know how to just stop spending money. They can't stop. And they want to save, and they want to buy a house, and I'm trying to teach them what that means. And so we're looking at their budget, and I'm looking like coffee, Steve. And they're like, oh, we can't give that up. No, we can't give that up. And my parents, like, I ate out once a month. That was it. And it was McDonald's, and I was allowed one burger. That was it. We took one family vacation before I was at the age of 10. One. We got in a car, we went to Niagara Falls, and we came back. And so how is our materialism, in a sense, and look, this is no socialist show, but how is our own materialism contributed to a part of this?
Well, it's obviously huge. It's sort of funny how, you know, sort of what goes in hand in hand with what I call the entitlement society is that nobody wants to give up their stuff. And I mean nobody. We're all, you know, sort of addicted to, you know, at least a few things. And it's sort of funny, but if you look at, you know, how successful people really behave, you know, what you'll find is they never really live beyond their means. They just don't.
Yep.
And I know I don't. My wife and I have never done that. And I'll tell you a funny story, but you know, we bought a home in Silicon Valley 21 years ago on a fairly large property. And the home was sort of run down. And we lived in that run down home on this beautiful piece of land for 15 years. And by the way, I was, you know, way into my 40s. No, early 50s before we actually put one penny into that house. And it was only after we had, you know, done quite well in the world and it was time. And my wife used to always look at me and say, you know what? We are the poorest living, well-off people I've ever known.
Yep, yep. So true. You know, my wife.
And it's the truth.
My wife and I finally built our first home that was really something we want. I just turned 55. And it was because we saved. We saved and we lived in tight quarters, and all of my friends had much bigger houses. And I just said, well, bless your hearts, but you can't afford the house you're living in. And I always think, my parents taught me, you live in the house you can afford to live in. You say the millennials, though, in the end, these kids are going to have to figure it out for themselves. You're saying they need to get to work. What makes you say that, Steve?
Well, the big issue here, that the reason I wrote the article, actually, the column, is that we have a strange situation in America where millennials have now become the largest generation. They are the largest demographic to hit the workforce. And they're also, unfortunately, the most unemployed, underemployed, and indebted generation probably in modern times.
Yep.
And what's happening, and this is really interesting, we've sort of been wondering why it is that the unemployment rate has been dropping, and we're sitting, you know, in the neighborhood of 5% now, but at the same time, the labor force participation rate is at its lowest since 1977.
Yep.
So the reason those two things, which seem contradictory, actually jive, is what's happening is millennials in record numbers are opting, they're not climbing the corporate ladder and building their career that way. They're not creating new companies as they were once, it was once thought that they would, over all the hype over the new entrepreneurial generation. Instead, they're opting for what they euphemistically call solopreneurship. And what they're really doing is becoming self-employed. And unfortunately, the problem with that is the self-employed people in America, and this is Bureau of Labor Statistics data right out of the book, are way, way less productive than the average worker. Just a quick fact, self-employed people now amount to 17% of the workforce in America, but they are only generating 7% of the GDP. So if you do the math, that means the self-employed people who are sort of opting for the convenience and the perceived benefits of being on their own are about a third to 40% as productive as the average worker. So the problem here is we now have, guys like me and you, Lee, we have the boomers starting to retire if we can.
Yep.
And, maybe wanting to take advantage of some of the entitlements that we paid into. And the generation that's supposed to be sort of helping to keep the coffers full, they're almost empty anyway, but at least keep them going and fund all of the entitlements that we've built up in this country, are the least productive we've ever had. And it's a bad combination.
It's a really bad combination for us and for them. And, it's interesting, this Uberization, because I don't know how many young people I meet who, they drive an Uber car, they're performance artists on the side, and what they're not learning is that sometimes giving up a little of that freedom can actually make your life a whole lot better. The other thing is, as you know, when you're self-employed, you've got yourself as a boss, and that doesn't always work out well. I really appreciate what you wrote, and what I'd love to do, Steve, is bring you back for an hour to talk about your book. Break it down, get through the chapters. We had you on for this one article, but it sounds to me like there's a lot longer we can spend together than just these 12 minutes. So would you come back?
Absolutely, I'd love to.
Well, we look forward to it. That's Steve Tobeck, and his book, Real Leaders Don't Follow, is what we will dig into. What we were talking about is the millennial mindset, which he wrote at Fox Business. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to hear this and hear everything we do. Take a listen, particularly to Jesse's really good work on the great Walt Disney film that I won't even mention here, so you have to go to the website and see. But it's a unique look into this film a story you've never heard before, only on Our American Stories. More after this. We'll be right back. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And one of the stories we like to talk about and dig into is law enforcement, public safety. And nobody writes better about this than Heather McDonald, who writes frequently for the Wall Street Journal. And Heather is the Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of The War on Cops. And she wrote a book called, she wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal called The Myths of Black Lives Matter. Heather, I wanted to dig into the meat of the piece, which is, what if Black Lives Matter, the movement, is based on fiction? And not just the fictional account you wrote in your column of the 2014 police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, but the other representations and misrepresentations of police shootings generally. Talk about that, Heather.
Well, Lee, the Black Lives Matter movement has been proclaiming endlessly in the most virulent, vicious terms for the last year and a half that police officers are the greatest threat facing young black men today. President Obama has confirmed his, you know, that the charge in his view that the criminal justice system is pervaded by explicit and implicit bias, and that there's an epidemic of cop killings going on. Well, it turns out that a much larger proportion of white and Hispanic homicide deaths come from police killings than black homicide deaths. 12% of all white and Hispanic homicide victims are killed by the police. 4% of all black homicide victims are killed by the police. So if we're going to have an anti-cop Lives Matter movement, which I don't think we should, but if we're going to, it would seem to be more justified in calling it white and Hispanic Lives Matter rather than Black Lives Matter.
Indeed. And let's talk also about the other side of that, which is who's committing the crime and where is the crime being committed? Talk a bit about that, Heather.
Well, the reason that police killings constitute 4% of all black homicide deaths as opposed to 12% of white and Hispanic homicide deaths is because the black homicide rate is so astronomical. It's blacks commit homicide at about 11 times the rate of whites. And each year, over 6,000 blacks die of homicide. That's more in absolute numbers than the number of whites and Hispanics combined who die of homicide, even though blacks are 13% of the population.
Yep.
So their death by homicide rate is about six times higher than whites and Hispanics combined, because they're shooting each other like crazy. And it's not whites who are shooting them, and it's not cops who are shooting them. It's other blacks who are shooting them.
Indeed. And, you know, you also wrote, Heather, the police officers of all races are also disproportionately endangered by black assailants. Over the past decade, according to FBI data, you write in the Wall Street Journal, 40% of cop killers have been black. Talk about that fact. And by the way, a lot of this came, we have to give credit to the Washington Post for some of this work, Heather, don't we?
Well, what the Washington Post has been doing is collecting every piece of information they can get on police killings. The federal tally, which has been kept by the FBI and then the Bureau of Justice Statistics, is notoriously incomplete. So what the Post has been doing is trying to create a database that it is complete by looking at news stories. And they found that just under 1,000 people were killed last year by the police. 26% of those people were black. The Post, yes, it's to be congratulated for that, but the number crunching in my Wall Street Journal article came from me. The Post has been trying to spin its database to conform to the Black Lives Matter movement. They've been writing about what they call unarmed black victims of police shootings. But if you dig deeply into the news stories on which they're, you know, basing their own reporting, those, many of those unarmed black
victims of police shootings were unarmed only for lack of success in trying to get the officer's gun away from him or trying to beat him unconscious. So, you know, that the Post, yes, good for them for getting the numbers, but I don't think they've been given the right spin. But and the data on police shootings of who kills cops, that's kept by private organizations and the FBI, and it is government data, as confirmed by private organizations, that about 40% of all cop killers over the last decade have been black. Again, 13% of the population is black. Black males, who were the majority overwhelmingly of those cop killers, are 6% of the population. That works out to a rate that blacks are 2.5 times, or excuse me, police officers are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by a black than a black male is to be killed by the cops.
Which might explain this part of your piece, Heather. You wrote in a 2015 study by the University of Pennsylvania criminologist Greg Ridgway, former acting director of the National Institute of Justice. He found that at a crime scene where gunfire was involved, black officers in New York City PD were 3 times more likely to discharge their weapons than other officers at the scene. Talk about that fact, because that's a big one.
Well, yes. I don't know how that would relate necessarily to the race of cop killers, but it certainly demolishes the Black Lives Matter conceit that the problem is racist white cops. You know, the Federal Justice Department has brought civil rights investigations of majority black law enforcement organizations. Now, if they're right on those or wrong on those, then they're also wrong on the other investigations. But for instance, Rikers Island, which is New York City's massive jail complex, the second largest in the country, is disproportionately run by black correctional officers. About 80% of Rikers Island corrections officers or jail guards are black in a city, New York City, that is 23%. So there's really disproportionate hiring going on there. And according to the U.S. attorney in New York City, Rikers has had a culture of violence against adolescent inmates. So, you know, maybe he's anti-cop, but then we have to question the investigations of other officers, other police forces. New Orleans, Detroit, they've all been under federal consent decree for civil rights violations. Those are majority black forces.
Right.
So, you know, what's going on with the shooting rate of black officers? I don't know whether they've been brought in under lower standards, which is something that plagues police departments across the country, and it's going to get worse given the pressure after Ferguson of this false narrative that white cops are the biggest threat facing blacks today. So you're going to have departments, they are under more and more pressure to hire by race, which is going to mean a lowering of standards, and that's going to mean potentially more questionable uses of force.
Well, and Heather, the reason I brought that up is that perhaps the black cops aren't quite as fearful to discharge their weapon as white cops, because white cops will fall under scrutiny. When a white cop shoots a black guy, CNN's all over it. When a black cop shoots a black guy, nothing. Nothing at all. Heather, if you could hold, we're going to just do another short segment. We wanted to get into the why of this stuff. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories and the work of Heather McDonald in the Wall Street Journal, The Myths of Black Lives Matter. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. If you're looking for hard news, you got the wrong channel. Left versus right, not doing it. But we are going to dig into stories that people care about and some of the best writing that people should care about. And nobody writes about our security, our lives, and the lives of our police officers better than Heather McDonald, who has written a piece called The Myths of Black Lives Matter in the Wall Street Journal. And often we turn to some of the journal's best writers because, well, they hit these issues better than anybody else in the country. And we were just talking about some of the myths of Black Lives Matter. We wanted to dig in with Heather about the media and how the media is, in a sense, enabling, if not making certain that Black Lives Matter movement has oxygen, which is what media coverage is. Heather, talk about, I know it's a running theme in your work, talk about the role the media plays in this movement. I think it actually created the movement.
Sure. I mean, the reality is, unfortunately, pretty much what the media decides it is by writing about it, putting it on TV. Otherwise, you know, if they decided not to cover these just hateful anti-cop protests, nobody other than the people who've been blocked from getting home from work or picking up their kid in school would know about it. And they privilege every claim of a racist officer and are almost silent about the daily toll of violence that goes on in the inner city. They turn their eyes away from it, and as a result, most Americans are utterly ignorant. Everybody knows, the world knows about Michael Brown. I was in Austria in the summer, in August of 2014, when Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson. The international CNN was covering it nonstop. German radio talks about it, but nobody knows the name of Marcus Johnson, who was a six-year-old boy shot in St. Louis, a few miles away from Ferguson, in March of 2015 in a drive-by shooting, a gang shooting. You know, Michael Brown was a thug. He tried to grab Officer Darren Wilson's gun, and yet he's still treated like a martyr, and the press still just refers to him as the prime example of the cops shooting an unarmed black male, leaving out an incident that led to Wilson's using force. But they will not talk about the dozens of children, three in Cleveland alone in September, who were killed by other blacks. So it's completely their choice in how to frame the narrative.
Indeed, and so often is the case, as we described just a little before, a black cop kills a black is it a black victim or a black perp? Nothing. It's when the white cop does something to a black. When a white cop kills a white guy, that's not a story either, Heather.
No, it's not. And the amazing thing is, I mean, the Baltimore situation is curious because there you do have three of the six cops who this out-of-control local prosecutor Marilyn Mosby has indicted. Three of the six cops involved in the arrest and transport of drug dealer Freddie Gray, who allegedly suffered a spine injury in transport to the police station that ultimately a week later resulted in his death. Three of those cops are black. In fact, the most important cops in that incident who transported him are black. It's still being slotted into the Black Lives Matter movement as an example of police racism, but at great expense and sort of consistency cost. So they're not really emphasizing the race of the officers in the way they would if it was all white.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, Heather. I periodically talk to some young people when I'm on the road, and we have stations all over the country. And I'll be in New York, and I'll ask a young crowd, how many people do you think used to get murdered a year in New York? Let's pick a year. Let's pick 1979 or 1982. And let's pick last year. Do you think the murder rates are up or down? Heather, they don't have a clue. Dig into how many black lives have been saved by the policing tactics that are now being vilified in these very places by groups like Black Lives Matter.
Well, in 1990 in New York City, there were 2,245 homicides. About 80% of those victims were black and Hispanic. last year there were a little over 300 homicides. So we've had a drop of about 80-85% in homicides in this year. Year after year, that's thousands, ultimately building up to thousands of minority males whose lives have been saved due to a revolution in policing that began in New York City in 1994 under Police Commissioner William Bratton during his first tour of duty that used data gathered on a minute-by-minute basis to relentlessly find emerging crime patterns and deploy police resources to where crime was breaking out, and to hold commanders ruthlessly and unapologetically accountable for their crime in their precincts. And that policing revolution, which goes by the shorthand term of CompStat, spread nationally, made policing much more efficient, much more accountable, much more information-driven, and the overwhelming beneficiaries of that have been minorities. You know, crime is a regressive tax on minority communities. That's what inhibits economic development. It's not racist governors or racist legislatures or you know, unfair tax policy. It's crime. You cannot have a vibrant urban economy with crime high. But if crime is a regressive tax on minority communities, then a crime drop is a progressive benefit, because when policing gets smarter, it's overwhelmingly minorities who disproportionately benefit.
Well, Heather, you did something amazing. You just said to me 2,200 plus murders a year in 1990, and then that was down to, you said, somewhere around the line of 300 last year. That leaves 1,900 more people alive, and you said 80% are victims. So that means that 1,520 times 25 years, which means some 35 to 40,000 black men, probably mostly, and some women too, are now alive because of the NYPDB. Forget just economic benefits. The human life benefit is unbelievable, Heather. What you just said is shocking.
I know, but it doesn't. Now, you know, the it's not as if you went every year, the difference between 2,000 and 300, that it dropped progressively, but there's definitely at least 10,000 minority males who are alive today who would have been dead had the crime rates remained at their early 1990s levels. And the fact is, you don't even have to do this by numbers. If you go to police community meetings in Harlem or the South Bronx or Central Brooklyn or South Central Los Angeles, what you inevitably hear from those law-abiding residents who show up, these good bourgeois, is we want more policing, not less. We want the drug dealers off the corners. I want the kids smoking marijuana out of my hallway and off my stoop. And those voices are never heard by the media.
You know, I'm not a big Spike Lee fan, but if you ever watch the movie Clockers, which was written by Richard Price, who I think a liberal in many respects, but there's a scene where a mother comes down and confronts these gangbangers in front of her project. And she's pointing at them and she's screaming at them, "You're murderers, you're thugs, go away." And everybody's just opening up their door and their windows and peering out and wondering whether these thugs are just going to shoot her or not. And she's got to be the voice of the majority in these communities, Heather.
Yeah, well, majority, I would hope so. You know, the fact is what the press, another thing the press doesn't get, Lee, is a lot of the people who bring complaints against the police are criminals, and they are engaged in retaliation. And there's a lot of people who are benefiting from criminal activity in inner city communities. And so they are not friends of the police. So a certain percentage of the anti-cop ideology that does exist side by side with support for law enforcement in inner city communities is driven by self-interest in crime.
Yep, no doubt. And then what do you say, just about a minute, there are police misconduct cases. I mean, I remember the Abner Louima case in New York City back when I lived there, and it was horrifying what happened to that guy. And talk about that and how the thin blue line can do a better job on that front, because sometimes cops do protect cops.
Yeah, they do. It's a very bunkered down profession, because, again, they are forced to see a reality that they're not allowed to talk about and that is excluded from public discourse. You know, I think that policing gets more and more professional. there have been bad shootings over the last year. The shooting of Walter Scott in North Charleston was clearly one of those bad shootings. And believe me, every police chief in this country is trying to do everything he can to eliminate those types of egregious misuses of force. But they are a minute proportion of the number of encounters that the police have every day. And it's appropriate, of course, to focus on making law enforcement even better. But if one-tenth of the attention that has been brought on the police over the last three decades could have been brought on black-on-black crime, we wouldn't be having this discussion about the police, which is just a very intense way of changing the subject.
No doubt about it. And Heather, your work is so appreciated. Heather McDonald, the Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and the author of The War on Cops and The Myths of Black Lives Matter. And by the way, that book is forthcoming in July from Encounter Books, a terrific publishing house. Again, this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Thank you, Heather, for joining us.
Thank you, Lee.
You bet.